Welcome to Honey and the Hex. We're a sibling duo exploring the origins, traditions, and intersections of folklore and where they lie today.
We've always been drawn to witchcraft and exploring our roots, so each episode will take you through our learnings of myths, magic, and mystery in English and Scottish folklore.
Hey, Coven. We hope you're all having a restful winter and being kind to yourselves and each other. This episode was a challenge to record due to COVID lockdowns. We recorded this with one hand microphone. The heating was broken and we were absolutely freezing. You'll be able to hear how bunged up I am. So the sound isn't up to usual standards, but we hope you enjoy it anyway, with all its imperfections. In 1963, two 16-year-old friends were returning to their homes after spending the evening at a friend's house in Highgate Village. Their route took them down Swain's Lane past the cemetery. To their horror, as they went past the gate at the top of the road, bodies began rising from graves. They were paralysed with fear.
Today we will be discussing the mystery of the Highgate vampire and the media frenzy that followed.
Yeah, our cousins and aunts have always lived in North London. So for us, like whenever we'd visit, we'd always come to Camden. It'd be really exciting. Obviously, you lived in Chalk Farm for ages. And then, I don't know, it was weird for me because when I first moved to London, when I was 18, I lived west just because that's where I was studying. But then ever since then, I've always been drawn back to North London. And it's weird because anywhere I've ended up living has had a connection to these sort of like spooky stories and poets and artists that I've always been a fan of. And then when I've looked into it, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's the road that I lived on. And there's all these weird connections.
Yeah, it's crazy. I went to school in Belsize Park, which was amazing when you first moved to London. And obviously I was just from Leicester, 16, went to musical theatre school in Belsize Park. And yeah, it was amazing. And I really do love North London to this day, even though I actually live east now.
We all have our places in London that we settle. To be honest, like I've got friends everywhere and I love different areas for different reasons. But you know when you feel at home somewhere, and I've always felt really at home north, and especially in Camden. I've settled permanently in Camden. But before that, I was living right next to Highgate Cemetery. And then when I moved, I had to move into a hostel for a bit for personal reasons. And that was literally just down the road from the cemetery. Even when I wasn't choosing where I was living, I was still living within those areas. And North London's actually really well known for its sort of supernatural behaviour. You've got Queen's Wood, Highgate Cemetery, Waterlow Park, lots of old pubs, Gothic mansions, and all those places, there are stories where people have seen things that have happened. And it's well known for big like coven meetups as well.
Yeah, a lot of covens do rituals in Highgate Wood. They do a lot of meetups there.
From the 1960s, there have been witchcraft rituals held in Queen's Wood, which is actually where I used to volunteer in the community garden. It's so gorgeous. It's like part of Highgate Wood. And the area is known also as the Witch's Circle. I won't go into this fully. There's so many things to touch on, and we've actually got so much to cover today on Highgate Cemetery and the vampire itself. But we will come back to this because there's so much, and so much that we personally have connections to. So we'll come back to that.
So let's get started. Highgate Cemetery in North London opened up in 1839, and it was opened up as one of the Magnificent Seven, being one of seven London cemeteries along with Kensal Green, West Norwood, Abney Park, Brompton, Tower Hamlets and Nunhead.
I've been to Nunhead and it's definitely my second favourite after Highgate Cemetery. Like, it's just stunning, very old, overgrown, so it's quite difficult to get to, but I do highly recommend.
So a bit of history. Early in the 19th century, there was a high mortality rate and a severe lack of burial space. So graveyards would be anywhere, anywhere where there was a bit of space, basically. So in between shops, pubs, houses, and it led to many illegal burials.
I love that. Just graves in between everywhere. That is so fun. Because London's population had increased so much, there was barely any burial space to accommodate the rise in population and obviously the death. Parliament passed a bill to open 7 new private cemeteries in London and surrounding areas, the Magnificent Seven.
And she is magnificent. I mean, we've been to Highgate Cemetery many times. Obviously, Tatum used to live right on there. So I would obviously visit Tatum, visit the cemetery. And we also went again a few weeks ago just to, you know, get a feel again for the cemetery. And oh, gosh. I couldn't recommend anywhere more. I'd recommend it to everyone. It's so beautiful. Beautiful, stunning, gothic architecture. And you really get a feel for how obsessed the Victorians were with death, because they were so obsessed with death. It was basically everything to them. And also for ancient Egypt, they were obsessed. And in the West Cemetery, there is the Egyptian Avenue, which has 16 vaults either side of a large passageway, which you enter through an arch. It's so beautiful. We will put some photos on the Instagram for sure from our most recent visit.
And the catacombs and the Circle of Lebanon, along with the Egyptian Avenue. It's just outstanding. Like, the wildlife was what shocked me so much. Like, all the ferns and fauna, like vegetation in there that I didn't expect to see in a London cemetery at all. Like, when I went to New Zealand and I was climbing mountains and going through forests, you'd see all these ferns and all these like spooky plants, and then it was there in London, and I was like, this is amazing, like really overgrown, just quite incredible to the eyes.
Spooky plants is now one of my favorite things. Where am I gonna set up a spooky plant shop? Ooh, little shop of horrors. Anyway, I digress. They actually discovered a rare species of spider in the Egyptian Avenue vaults 7 years ago, which is the orb weaver spider. And she requires total darkness to survive. And they all could have thrived there for up to 150 years. And they found up to 100 spiders. And they're big. I personally am quite scared of spiders for a witch. I have always been scared of spiders. I don't know why. And everyone gets really annoyed at me because, like, if I'm like in this back room where we are now, if I say to Tatum, can you get that spider? I say it to my boyfriend all the time, can you get the spiders? Like, everyone gets pissed off at me.
I'm not like obsessed with spiders where I'm going to pick it up and play with it, but I'm also like, okay, if that spider needs moving, cool, it's fine. But I did live in Australia, so
I actually don't think I could go to Australia for that reason. I have been a little bit better. And do you know what is really funny? I like looking at photos of spiders, and I like looking at spiders that are in like cases, you know, when you go to the museum. And I like tattoo spiders and cartoon spiders. So
love a good spider web as well.
I really went off on my phobia of spiders. Yeah, but taking it back. So the Victorians' obsession with death and lavish burials, it made Highgate Cemetery highly sought after. To be fair, we want to be buried there as well, so it's very relatable. They had to actually open the East Cemetery on the other side of Swains Lane,
which is where I lived, so it was so ideal. Like, my kitchen would just look onto the cemetery, so I'd sit there having a cup of tea, like sit up on the counter and just look out at the dead.
That is actually perfect, to be honest. And I really loved visiting you there. Anyway, by the turn of the century, people were having less extravagant funerals, so there was less money for upkeep, and it really began to decline. Families would move away or die out, and it's obviously really hard to maintain with very little money. And then obviously carrying on from that, the German bombing damaged the vaults in World War II, and honestly just a lot of vandalism throughout the years. And by 1960, the dire state of Highgate Cemetery was notorious, really well known.
Right, so sticking to that era for the time being, Elizabeth Siddell, known as Lizzie, was born in London in 1829 and died in 1862. She was a poet, artist, and artist model. You have probably seen the John Everett Millais painting of Ophelia, which she posed for. She was the model for artists of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which we won't go into because it's not that kind of podcast.
All about the women here. Let's stick to them.
We've heard enough of men throughout history. So, you know, that's all covered. We're going to concentrate on the women because they deserve it. Yeah, so she was an artist in her own right. She was actually the only woman to have her work included in the first ever exhibition of Pre-Raphaelite art in 1857.
Yeah, she was a truly amazing woman, and also her beauty alongside that has been spoken about extensively, particularly her long red flowing hair, which she was famous for. So taking it back a bit, when she posed for John Everett Millais for Ophelia in 1852, she was 19 years old, and she was required to lay fully clothed in a bathtub for 7 hours. As it was winter and obviously Victorian London, freezing, Millais had placed oil lamps under the tub to warm the water, but it was just dirty ass water from the Thames. And it didn't really cut it, and Lizzie started to shiver. She didn't want to complain, as her family were extremely poor, and she would earn more from this modelling job than working a whole year as a milliner's apprentice. That was her job, and that's where she was actually discovered by the artists. And I think, yeah, her brother had just died from TB, and they really needed the money, so she stayed silent. Professional as fuck. But yeah, eventually Millais noticed she was shivering and he got her out of the bathtub.
And she caught pneumonia, right?
Yeah. And her family were obviously really angry and threatened to sue. And they even called a doctor, which was extremely rare for such a poor family at the time. And I think her doctor's bills were paid. They did try and look after her, but the doctor prescribed her laudanum, which is an opiate in alcohol, and she sadly became dependent on this.
She met her husband, also part of the pre-Raphaelite brotherhood, Dante Gabriel Rossetti. She became a model exclusively for her husband, Rossetti, and they had a very turbulent relationship. It is said that he was her mentor, but some say tormentor.
Yeah, so Lizzie had an unspecified illness, consumption often referenced.
And Rossetti kept postponing their wedding. She continued to use laudanum, which you could buy over the counter. She most likely had an eating disorder, anorexia or bulimia, but that was not spoken about then. Rossetti became impatient with her ill health, and his mother did not approve of Lizzie due to her working class background and lack of formal education.
And he had started to use other women as models and began having multiple affairs around 1856, which obviously left Lizzie devastated. And her use of laudanum became more frequent and her health declined further. And by 1860, she was really unwell, and he finally promised to marry her. He really tormented her. He treated her quite badly. And yeah, when he finally married her, which was about 9 or 10 years after they actually met, she began to recover and she fell pregnant. Sadly, she had a stillborn daughter, which again triggered the use of laudanum again.
It's awful. She died of a laudanum overdose in 1862 at just 32 years old. And just 2 years after her marriage to Rossetti. Many say Rossetti drove her to her suicide with his nasty behaviour. Oscar Wilde had told people that he pushed the bottle into her hands and told her to drink the lot, but who knows?
Love Oscar Wilde.
Yeah, good for him, actually. Not that men should deserve awards for looking out for women and speaking the truth, but I'm glad he did.
Well, the gays have the women's back.
That's it, isn't it?
Probably would have been quite fun to live back then, I guess, if you were white and rich.
Yeah, but only then.
Only then, yeah. So in his grief, he buried unpublished poems with Lizzie, his own poems, which was a final token of his love and some say guilt. And he had kept her coffin in their apartment for 6 days before she was buried in Highgate Cemetery. And it's said he saw her ghost every night for 2 years. 7 years later, he actually decided he wanted those poems back. He wanted to publish the poems. Times were hard. He had very little money, but he couldn't remember them by heart. He checked with his family and no one had the manuscript, or he checked with anyone who may have potentially had. He had given a manuscript to, but he had no luck. Running out of money and now also addicted to drugs, he had Lizzie exhumed in secret. So he had her dug up so he could retrieve his poems that he gave as a last gift to her. I don't know what to say about that, really.
That's not selfish at all. Like, wow, that's stooping to new lows.
And in secret as well. So he obviously knew that he was, you know, was doing something wrong. He wasn't actually present for the exhumation. And this is the very strange part, which is what we were getting to. It is said when they opened the coffin, her body had not decomposed at all. And her famous red hair had continued to grow. So this is 7 years later. She's been buried. She's been now disturbed. And she hasn't decomposed. So yeah, that is pretty crazy.
That's eerie as fuck.
So this obviously gave Lizzie titles. There was a lot of gossip back then. I mean, there is now, but like titles such as Undead and Vampire, and another, the start of a close link between Highgate Cemetery and vampires and the supernatural. And it is highly likely that Bram Stoker was inspired by this story of Lizzie for his character of Lucy in Dracula, although he never referenced this. And Stoker actually lived in the same neighborhood as Rossetti. Bram Stoker's character of Lucy in Dracula has red hair, and she even mentions Ophelia in one of her diary excerpts, which would be taking it back to obviously Lizzie, who posed for, as Ophelia for John Everett Millais. And it's even said that Stoker was present at her exhumation. So lots of connections.
Yeah, and it just seems like at that time, all of these artists and poets were all sharing stories, because you see so many connections. Another weird one is Christina Rossetti's uncle, John Polidori. He wrote The Vampire when he was staying at Lord Byron's house on Lake Geneva with Mary and Percy Shelley. They were all stuck there when there was a huge storm, and then they all decided to pass the time by writing horror stories. And that's when Mary Shelley, my favourite person. That's when Mary Shelley created Frankenstein.
Yeah, the connections are just crazy. And I mean, we really went off on like many tangents trying to like piece all of this together.
Okay, so the actual Highgate vampire.
On Friday, 27th of February, 1970, the front page headline of the Hampstead and Highgate Express asked, "Does a vampire walk in Highgate?" There would be no going back. The die had been cast. So that excerpt is from Sean Manchester's book, The Highgate Vampire. Sean Manchester, along with David Farrant, were two of the protagonists who brought this case to light, and their feud actually became infamous, and they, you know, they were arguing about this case up until David Farrant's death last year in 2019. So yeah, this is what we're going to be talking about. So by 1970, Highgate Cemetery's gates had deteriorated to the point that people could just use the cemetery for anything they wanted. They had free rein, so it was many teenagers fulfilling dares, graffiti, just a general do whatever you want atmosphere. And there were a lot of homeless people living in the cemetery also.
It's so weird to think about the cemetery like that when it's today. It's so looked after and it's so difficult to get in, but obviously they had to really change things around. So imagine, yeah, people just going in and doing whatever they want.
Now you have to pay a tenner to get in.
Which, to be honest, I used to think that's actually ridiculous. But now, like, looking into it, you kind of understand why they're so strict about it. And they do concessions and things. Kind of think, why would I pay to go into a graveyard? And then, well, we'll tell you why.
And they actually, the Highgate Cemetery, get really pissed off if you mention the Highgate Vampire. We obviously didn't do that because we did our research before. But yeah, they really are not happy because, I mean, it was a really hard time with graffiti, cameras, just everything around. Don't ever mention that to them.
So we're talking about when David Farrant and Sean Manchester came onto the scene as members of the British Occult Society, which was formed in the late 1960s. Farrant's wife has stated this group was established by a group of friends who would visit the cemetery at night around 1966. It started as harmless activity, just teenagers scaring themselves.
Yeah, like legend tripping. So a lot of folklorists talk about legend tripping. It's like a rite of passage, kind of like when you have to do dares. What's that? What's it called when you have to do dares at like in sorority houses and stuff? Like hazing rituals, stuff like that. So it would be like, oh, you have to climb up on this gravestone and say Bloody Mary three times, like something like that. We had a house down the bottom of our road, which is still there, but it's been changed now.
Yeah, it was a really old house and it was there for years. It's only, I think this is the first time I've been in Leicester and then seen that it's been changed. So it must have been changed quite recently, but it'd been there and everyone would walk past and we'd all say, like, you have to ring on the doorbell. And basically from the outside, it looked like it was sort of being eaten alive from the inside, and everything was crumbling. It was all overgrown. You could see through a peek in the curtains where there was like all these bookshelves, but like messy, like dirty. Everything looked, you know, when you get tea bags, when you used to do stuff at school and you get tea bags and then you'd drop them on paper to make it look like a pirate's map or parchment. It looked like the whole house was covered in that.
That is so true. That's actually such a good description of this house. And everyone would say a mad professor lived there. And if you knocked, you know, he would take you into the house and you'd disappear, basically. That poor man, he was probably just a man just trying to live his life, didn't have much help, didn't have any family. And then he's got all these kids terrorizing him.
Yeah, you'd be annoyed, wouldn't you? But he also had something saying you couldn't knock, didn't he?
Yeah, it says it had like a poster saying, don't knock, don't ring, don't even call.
Which is so creepy. He wasn't helping himself, bless. But yeah, he probably just wanted to chill on his own with all his books. But anyway, so as you can see with what happened in the cemetery, like, this could have been harmless activity, teenagers and, you know, thinking about witchcraft. But there was vandalism involved. This was really awful for the cemetery and awful for family members and locals. So they stopped going to the cemetery. But when David Farrant returned to the cemetery in 1969, he said it had gone out of control. So, quote from him, vaults had been broken open and literally smashed apart. One vault near the top gate was wide open and one could see the remains of a skeleton where it had been wrenched from the coffin. Another vault on the main pathway had been entered and one of the coffins set alight. So, like, the vandalism was just, like, a real problem.
Meanwhile, when all this was happening, there had been many supernatural sightings in the area, specifically reports of a tall, dark spectre which had paralysed people with fear. There was also reports of bodies rising from graves, animals drained of blood with lacerations to the neck. There was a lot of supernatural reports, and this is even before David Farrant and Shaun Manchester came onto the scene. So there's a lot of reports. London and North London had become such a place for supernatural activity, and that's where this all started, really. Usually, obviously, when animals are injured, they will go somewhere safe to die, but these animals had just been left in the middle of the pathway drained of blood. So it is obviously very strange, and there was a lot of reports of Satanism and everything like that. So it was all getting out of control. David Farrant had been fascinated by these reports, as he was a member of the British Occult Society. He chose the winter solstice of 1969 to spend a night at Highgate Cemetery. He said shortly before midnight, a 7-foot-tall shape appeared with eyes, not of a human's, and then he realised he was under psychic attack and tore his eyes away and the figure disappeared. This is when Farrant wrote to the Hampstead and Highgate Express, known to North Londoners as the Ham and High. Love the Ham and High. about this experience. And this started a whole array of stories and sightings and local superstition. And, you know, all these stories were in the Ham and High for everyone to read. So it really set people off. Also, another Highgate resident said there were many tales told of a tall man in a hat who would disappear through cemetery walls, and the old bell in the disused chapel in the cemetery would ring as the man walked.
So there was just, like, so many piling up of these sightings. And also seen by another person in Waterloo Park was a man, a tall man with a hat, and that was, like, where Waterloo Park is. It's around the corner from Swain's Lane.
I can literally just picture this spectre as the one in Haunting of Hill House, you know, the one with the bowler hat that's levitated off the floor. Maybe they took inspiration from this, because that's exactly the description. There was also a ghostly bicyclist chasing women down Swain's Lane. Not a nice place to be, really. In the dark.
No, and what's weird is, like, I used to get off at the end of Swain's Lane, and the C11s come every 20 minutes, the buses. So if there wasn't a C11 coming for 20 minutes, then I'd have to walk along Swain's Lane, past the cemetery, get to the Highgate Library, and then walk along that road until I got to where I lived. And it was always creepy, but to be honest, I'm that person who walks around cemeteries. Like, I used to take naps in cemetery, on cemetery benches. Like, I just love it. So I didn't find it scary. The scariest thing is looking over your shoulder, wondering if somebody's actually following you. And I'm not talking about a ghost, I'm talking about men. So I'm glad that I'm doing all of this extra research and learning now about all these stories, because if I'd known it then, I would have had to deal with that fear as well. Like, I do think that maybe it would have made me feel even more scared and chilled, like walking along there. And I probably would have projected and seen some things.
Definitely. It's really interesting. I haven't personally seen anything like that around that area, but it's definitely something to look out for.
So yeah, a media frenzy started. So everyone was hunting down a vampire. There were occult obsessives. Also, it was around the time when The Wicker Man came out. So for the folk horror fans, you'll know about that. So all of this stuff was going on.
Everyone was getting really excited. We actually, The Wicker Man's our mum's favourite film, so...
Controversial, but I don't really like The Wicker... I don't really like The Wicker Man.
Probably because mum made you watch it so many times. Mm. Anyway, like we said, Highgate Cemetery today, they get pissed off when you bring it up. So there was also a pub regular that said... This man that had been seen, this spectre, when he'd been going around all the different pubs on his pub crawl, he had said that people were giving this spectre different names. So the Wild Eggman, Mad Arthur and the White Ghost were some names that have been used for this character. By this point, also David Farrant and Sean Manchester, their feud had just been getting out of control as well. They would just slag each other off wherever they could, to newspapers, to TV stations, because we have to remember that this was a massive story. It was all over in the papers. Everyone was at the cemetery. Both Farrant and Manchester were contacted by ITV for an interview. And obviously ITV is a huge TV station in the UK. And this is from Bill Ellis's Folklore Journal. They were contacted by ITV for an interview to be broadcast on Friday, March 13th. So standing in front of the cemetery's gates, Farrant claimed to have received threatening letters with black magic symbols on them, warning him to stay away from things he could not understand. And Manchester repeated his description of how to destroy a vampire and warned Farrant indirectly, "He goes against our explicit wish for his own safety. We feel he does not possess sufficient knowledge to exercise successfully something as powerful or evil as this vampire, and he may well fall victim as a result." So they're just completely just constantly going back and forth saying, "You're not qualified to kill this vampire. I'm the best vampire hunter."
We've all seen that ego clash before, haven't we?
I mean, if anything needed to be exercised, it was a male ego. The programme also aired a series of ghost stories from a group of young neighbourhood children. They were saying things like, "I actually saw its face and it looked like it had been dead for a long time." Everyone was getting involved. The television programme came onto the air at 6 p.m. 2 hours later, Swains Lane was packed with a crowd of would-be vampire hunters who arrived by foot, car, van and bus. And by 10 o'clock, a witness said the onlookers resembled a football crowd, and there were several squads of police unsuccessfully trying to control the mob, which was shaking the cemetery gates and scaling the walls.
For people who haven't been to this area of London, Swains Lane, it's not like a big main road, so you can imagine all these people, like, it's a long road. It goes along from Hampstead Heath and then curves round. You've got like Holly Lodge and all these old mansions and things and the cemetery, but the roads itself, they're not like big main roads, so they must have just been so crammed and so hectic. And yeah, people were just obsessed. They wanted to see the vampire, or they wanted to be there to be the one who would put a stake through its heart.
Yeah, and can you imagine all these people with stakes, with scary, like, you know, knives or whatever, to try and kill this vampire because they believed that the vampire was there because of this ITV broadcast? Yeah, it would have just been out of control and very dangerous, to be honest. So that's when it really escalated. It was getting even worse. A woman's charred remains were found by police, and there was also reports of similar activity in Southwark. So London had just gone mad for vampire hunting and a lot of satanic activity. There were a lot of remnants of, you know, candles and different kinds of like activity like that in the woods, in places, in parks. So yeah, London had just gone wild for it.
You can still see some things when you go through Queen's Wood. You still see some things hanging and stuff. This was like, people were just seeing it everywhere. It must have been pretty scary. I mean, for people who, like, we do rituals and practice, so when we'd see that, we wouldn't feel so like terrified by it, because it's like, oh cool, that's just a little ritual and could be an innocent thing. But for people from, you know, who are, let's say, very religious, or just assume that these are satanic practices that are really extreme, because obviously there's lighthearted stuff and innocent stuff, and then there's extreme in everything. So for so many people, they must have just been terrified. Okay, so unfortunately, back to the two men. The climax was their magician's duel on Parliament Hill. There had been posters put up over London underground stations which urged people to come and watch. Farrant did not show up as he feared being lynched. Manchester then did an exorcism in front of reporters to banish Farrant's evil powers. Oh, you can just imagine it, can't you? Like, this is a serious thing. People have seen things, whether you believe that or not. People were speaking out about what they'd seen, different activity. People's stories were really valid. And then there's these two men just making it all about them. Who's going to be the best vampire killer? Like, oh.
And the fact that they, every opportunity they had to discredit each other and say that they were the best, like, it was just constant. And it really ended up discrediting other people's stories, because of course, like, if people are seeing these things, like you said, they believe that, but it's just getting caught up in this whole media frenzy between these two self-proclaimed, like, neither of them are magicians. I think maybe they're into Wicca and that stuff, and that's completely respect that, but who has a degree in vampire hunting?
And that's the thing, like, women probably would have come together, okay, let's both stick together and try and hunt this vampire. What's really sad about it is when you look into the Highgate vampire, it's all about these two men. They've almost become the story. And actually, they're not the story. They put themselves in front of the cameras, and as you said, yeah, respect their work, but their work isn't specifically this. And dueling on Parliament Hill, come on, give me a break.
The fact that when David Farrant didn't show up because he feared being lynched or whatever, because Sean Manchester had said he was the dark magician and himself was the white magician, so he was giving him like an evil, he was the evil one. And the fact he just did a whole exorcism in front of TV cameras and like loads of people because Farrant didn't show up. Just imagine him just stood there doing his monologue, like doesn't not have a fucking clue what he's doing, but he's just like winging it and just getting all of that media attention. And that's obviously what they both loved. And, you know, when I do watch interviews of David Farrant, I kind of see him as like a Russell Brand type character. He, with all respect to him, of course, he definitely loved the camera, and he spoke in a kind of ye old English type of way that no one was speaking in the 70s, you know. So I just think that, yeah, he was definitely a character and definitely had this persona. But they're both interesting people for sure, and you can read about them like a lot.
Well, that's what's also interesting, because maybe I've got a very limited view of the 70s. I didn't expect there would still be people speaking this ye old English, and I guess it was just characterization, the same way now you go and do a ghost tours in London and someone's wearing a top hat and they're, do you know what I mean? So it's obviously just that.
I actually did a Dylan Thomas tour of Fitzrovia where this guy was taking us around, and we go into the different like pubs that Dylan Thomas drank in and wrote poems in, and he didn't break character, so good for him. But yeah, they're definitely, and there's actually, I was researching on YouTube, there's another tour guide, I think they're always in like a bowler hat or something, doing a tour of the Highgate Cemetery, and yeah, it's, bless them, that is, it is, it's a job, and they don't break character, it's professional.
Yeah, get your peas, do you know what I mean? Gotta pay your rent somehow. What do you think, like, what do you believe or not believe?
I mean, it's hard to say. I don't believe that there was a vampire. I believe that maybe there was, people did see something, and that was probably, whether it's shadows that you think that have turned into something else, or people saw something. I know that for sure. I believe these people. I'm not sure I believe in vampires in the way they're portrayed in film now and books now and everything. There's definitely people that suck the life out of you and the energy out of you, so there's vampires in that way. But yeah, I do believe that there's a lot of supernatural activity in North London. And while I personally haven't seen any myself, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I think that anything is possible in life. You know, we all don't know what we're doing here, so anything is possible. But personally, I don't think there was a Highgate vampire. I've had my own experience with feeling a presence. I've lost people and then had weird things happen to show that they were around. But obviously, I'm not saying that's a definite thing, because it can always be an extension of our imagination, or it can be something can happen and then we can label it as that and we can try and find signs. I don't really know. And I think that's okay. Like, I'm at the point where I don't need a definite on things. I think that people saw things, and whether that was because they were projecting or they were scared. So as you said, they were seeing a shadow and then it looked like something and then they decided it was a figure, you know. So I think that people saw things and I think that that's valid. And I think that maybe there are some spirits that hang around Highgate Cemetery. I think the disappointment was that it's been all those people who really had who wanted to tell their stories were discredited by people being vandalizing, jumping on it and being violent, big egos and that sort of thing. But North London, it's got such an amazing gothic feel to it, which is just why I just love it. And I will always think I'll always stay in North London. By the way, it was just a council flat. Like, it wasn't like some massive mansion looking onto the cemetery. But that was what's really interesting about it, because they have these block of this council estate looking over to the cemetery. And then, you know, you've got roads on the other side of it that are like crazy expensive. And I guess that's the same of anywhere in London. You've got the juxtaposition of
the obnoxious houses.
And then you've got council estates and you've got social housing.
Back in the day, like North London and all these like Hampstead and places, they were like a bohemian area where artists would live, and whether you can afford to live there now or not is a different question. Is a different question because the prices are ridiculous.
It is a shame, I guess, with everywhere in London that people who aren't rich are being forced out when they had so much character.
We would love to continue our North London paranormal activity search, to be honest, because we couldn't cover everything in this episode, but we'd actually love to continue. We'd love to do a Queenswood episode. So let's hope that Tatum and I don't turn into David Farrant and Shawn Manchester and start saying, oh, I'm the Queen of North London.
Oh my God, imagine. And also, if you're going to, you know, look more into this story and tell people about the Highgate Vampire, remember to put women at the beginning of the narrative, because they're the real heroes.
Definitely. And I think we should just remember that even all of this stuff that happened in the 70s with all the media frenzy and everything, remember what happened back in the Victorian era. Remember Lizzie Siddell. Remember everything. Thank you for joining Honey in the Hex. Subscribe on whichever platform you get your podcasts on.
Connect with us on Instagram at Honey in the Hex. It's a joy to grow our coven, and we're always open to hear what you would like us to cover on the podcast. See you next time.